more into truth than our acting, we wouldn't be doing it with just those number 42 voices at all. We'd be creating whole human beings again. And written with some of the best writers that we could get again. See, there's a lot of here we is in the kitchen. You know, I used to say that about the Amos Nandy show. That used to be what we called radio acting. Here we is in the kitchen. You always had, to say where you were. But, for instance, if you created a person or two people standing on a windy crag, shall we say, cold and unhappy and ill, all those things happening, you can create all those things with your voice. You can have the sound effect going, and two people can create a lot of atmosphere while they're saying the words. But you have to feel the thing and be there while you're saying the words. It isn't just on the paper. You should get off the paper. It's a world of exquisite imagination.
Reminiscing, I feel you near. Once more, you're my love of yesteryear.
Yes, it is your old friend Singing Sam. So let's just settle back and reminisce a bit. What do you say, huh?
With a nostalgic nod to the Atwater Kent, we now present Same Time, Same Station, a chronicle of broadcasting's first half century.
Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear.
Tonight, Maureen Tuttle remembers radio.
I've got beginner's love. The first time that I'm in love with you. Gosh, I'm lucky I've got.
It's 1937, and I was appearing then on a show called White Fires of Inspiration. It was a stories of great artists and painters and writers. For instance, I did George Sand. I did the story, the life of a great person who was inspired. And that's the kind of show I really prefer to do. It was thrilling for me because I was quite young. I'm sure you must know that I was, not too grown up. And it was thrilling to play those women because I had everything going for me. I was the right age for them. I'd love to play them now, but of course it wouldn't be the right age for them now. But I notice here from my little book that I was on White Fires, and I was on a show called House Undivided, Showboat, Hollywood Hotel. See, I was the original Ginny on Hollywood Hotel with Dick Powell. We started that show, I think, a little sooner than this. This is my second book. I have three books here full of the shows. And I was chosen over a great many little young starlets, we might say, who had been sent to the audition from the studios. So the people who brought them and the agents and the people who were trying to exploit them were very angry with me because I won over about 60 girls. But I had had stage training, you see. I'd had a wonderful background before I even tried out for this thing. So not only did I have something in my reading of the character, but he knew that I had poise and presence to stand up there in front of an audience. Because in those days, and I must make this very clear, and I'd like to make it clear at the very beginning, that the Hollywood shows were not just studio shows. We were performers in radio. See, we stood out in front of audiences, and you not only had to look well or look the part and dress well, be presentable, certainly, like you were in the theater, like I was used to being in the theater, being a leading lady for about 8 years, but you had to be able to do comedy to get laughs out there in front of that audience, because I worked so many comedy shows, which I adore, and it was live, too, so it was very spontaneous, and the timing was so marvelous to do. I worked with all of the fine comics in those days. I was with Red Skelton, by the way, for 7 years. I played all the girls on the show. When I started out, Verna Felton was Nama on it, and I played Mummy, Junior's Mummy. And I was Junior's Mummy, I guess, for about 7 years. I have some tapes from that. I love to listen to the shows, too, because they're so funny. I think Red was funnier in radio. Of course, he had an audience to work to. But I think he was funnier in radio than he was in this show. I think the reason I say he was funnier was because we were all with him so much, so long, and he trusted us. See, we didn't worry if he wavered from the script. Well, if you're working with Red on the stage, with like in television, you know, in front of an audience, he wavers and you get a little rattled. But we never did because we had the script in front of us. We knew that whatever he did, he'd come back to the right cue.
And now, our next story about stray animals. All children love animals, and they're forever finding pets that they just can't live without. Chapter 87 is entitled Junior, the Mean Little Kid, and the King of the Beasts.
What's wrong with your lips? They're all green.
Well, you know those ferns in the living room?
Yeah.
Well, do you want to go see them or do you want to remember them as they were? What were you yelling for me for, Keogh?
Oh, if you'll run a little errand for me, I'll give you a bright, shiny new penny.
Well, I'd rather have a dull old worn-out nickel. Where to, Keogh?
I want you to go to the store for Mummy.
Yeah, what do you want me to get?
A dozen eggs, a loaf of bread, and a pound of butter. I wish we could get a nice steak.
A steak? What's that?
You wouldn't know. You're too young.
Yes.
Oh, and get some Frankfurters.
Frankfurters? Okay.
Junior, what do you want?
Well, give me a loaf of bread, a dozen of hinge fruit, and...
Hinge fruit?
Eggs.
Oh.
Stupid. Yeah. Big fat slob.
Why do you call me a big fat slob?
I called him the way I see him. Give me a loaf of bread.
Yes.
Last night, my mommy sent me papa for some rye bread, see? Mm-hmm. He found a rye, but he couldn't get any bread. Give me a loaf of bread, a dozen of eggs, and a pound of butter, It's something like that, anyhow.
Yeah.
Butter.
Did you bring the cash?
No, this is credit.
No dice.
My mummy has sent me down here for some food.
Yeah.
I is in no mood to dicker about finances today. Now, my little tummy will start growling around 6 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
I is going to have some victuals to warm me little innards.
Yes.
Now, as I said before, I is in no mood to dicker. Now, do you see that great big window out there in front of your store?
Yes.
Do you get the hint or do I get the food?
Okay, you get the food.
Okay.
Here's the butter. Now, what else was it?
Let's see. Some Frankfurters. Frankfurters.
Huh?
Hot dogs, hamburgers with tights on.
Oh, yeah.
And a can of vegetable soup.
Vegetable soup? What's vegetable soup?
Vegetable soup?
Yes, vegetable soup.
You know what? You ever have hash?
Yes, I've had
hash. This is the same thing, only it's looser.
Look, are you going to eat these hot dogs for supper?
No, I'm not going to eat them. I'm going to make handlebar grip from a tricycle. Oh, look, there's a big circus wagon. Look at that.
That's the keeper of the zoo.
Huh?
Howdy.
Howdy. Is this your little boy?
No, his little boy belongs down the street.
Well, you better hurry home, kid. One of our lions is missing from the zoo.
Well, why should I run? I ain't got him. Besides, I wouldn't know what a lion looked like if I see him.
Junior, a lion can hurt you.
Yeah, I know. Me pop got beat up on for lying the other night to mummy.
Junior, you better hurry home.
Yeah, okay. I'm going to hurry home. Big lion loose somewhere. I'm going to take a shortcut up this alley. I'll get home before I find out what a lion is. Hippity-hop, we off, we off. I think I'm going to jump across this big mud puddle here. I think I'll swim across this mud puddle here. I better hurry. I'm going to hurry. Great heavens, what's that? Never in my life have I seen a dog so big. What a big fellow. He's got his big, what a big red bushy hair he got. He got a big bushy head, and he shaved off in the middle, and he got a paintbrush on the end of his tail. Get up! What's the matter? Don't you like me? Well, I like you. I really don't, but I gotta protect myself. Look, now, look, go away, dog. Don't you bite me. You never have hydrophobia, have you, huh?
Yeah.
Neither has I, but that scares me, see. What you sniffing at? What's the matter? You hungry? Here, I'll give you me hot dogs. Because I... Ooh, good heaven, look at them teeth. I'm afraid of them big teeth. I just put these things on the ground and you can eat them down. Good heavens, look at him eat them hot dogs, newspaper and all. He didn't even ask for mustard. Boy, that's the kind of dog I need, boy. Something can protect me. Come on, how would you like to go home with me? Oh, look at that long... Stop it, will you? Stop it, boy. What a face washer he'll make, huh? Yeah, you know, I don't think my mommy's going to let me keep you, but we'll see, huh? I could hide you in my room. Or still better, I could put you in mommy's room and surprise her. Then again, I don't know why I'm standing here wasting my time. I'm going to take you home anyhow. Come on, puppy. Come on, puppy dog. Come on. Here, now you stay outside while I see if the coast is clear or not. Uh-oh. There's me mummy's eyeglasses. I better hide them. Then she won't be able to see the dog so well. Now, come on, doggy. Come on, come on. Come on, big boy. Boy, what big feet you got. Boy, he's a long one, too, ain't he, boy? I'll bet I could pat him on the head in the living room and have to run out in the kitchen to see if he was wagging his tail.
Junior, is that you? What happened to your voice?
That vitamin B1's backfired on me. Come on. Oh, Mummy.
Yes, dear. You got the grocery?
Yes, here's the bread, the butter, and the eggs. Scrambled eggs, of course. Hey, Mummy, you know what we need around this house?
No, what?
Is a widow dog. A widow watchdog.
What have we got to watch?
Well, he could watch me to see that I don't run away.
And spoil my hopes?
Yes.
Definitely not.
I sure as love, didn't I, huh?
Good heavens, what was that?
Well, you're going to find out anyway, so I guess I'll tell you. I brought home a dog, and he's the nicest, friendly little thing. He's so friendly, he probably eats off your hand.
Junior, let's see him. Where are my glasses?
Didn't you leave them on the table?
Well, I thought I did.
And then didn't I come back from the store?
Yes.
See, she just can't put two and two together. Show him to you.
Yeah.
Oh, my. He barks strange.
Yes.
What kind of a dog is he?
He's a chihuahua.
Well, he's awfully big to be a chihuahua.
Yes, his father was a St. Bernard. Look, he's so nice. Look at him. Look me hug him around the neck. Look at
him. Get your head away from his mouth. He might bite your head and break his teeth.
Yes. Oh, please let me keep him.
Now, don't cry.
I don't have anyone to play with.
Oh, poor baby. Does he want a dog?
Yes, I want a dog.
Will you be good to him?
Yes, I'll be good to him.
Oh, bless his little heart.
Yes, yeah, bless his little heart.
Well, let me get a little better look at him.
Yes.
Only I could remember where I put my glasses.
Yes.
He seems to have a red, bushy head.
Yes, he's got a great big red, bushy head.
Is it bright red?
Real bright red.
He's sort of yellow all over?
He is red and yellow all over.
What are you going to name him?
Blackie.
Where did he go?
He's going upstairs. He's walking up the steps. Oh, he sure likes you. He can't keep his eyes off of you. Look at him crawling along there. Hold still. I think he's going to jump in your arms.
Doc!
Boy, you duck guessing time, boy.
Junior, you get that dog out of here now.
I'll put him down in the basement until he gets used to it. You know what I think would help him? A little bicarbonate. Well, where are we going to feed him?
Oh, he'll find something.
I'll bet he will.
I wonder if I left my glasses in the living room. Junior, you left that radio on again, didn't you?
We interrupt this program to announce that a lion has escaped from the zoo and is still at large. The park commissioner wants everyone to use extreme precaution, as this beast is a killer. And now we return you to Tubby Bloot and his zoo flute.
Shut that thing off. Junior, now don't you go outside the house. There's a lion. A lion!
What's wrong?
Junior!
What?
That thing in the basement. Oh, dear.
Oh, dear.
It's not a dog.
It's not a dog.
It's a lion.
It's a lion. Ah!
Why I say radio was better than now. Radio catered to inspirational things. Now, not particularly churchy things. I don't mean that word at all. But I mean radio dramatized lives of great and interesting and meaningful people. Well, I don't see that so much now. I don't see anything that I do, you know, anymore. That has any nobility or any ambition or anything that I believe in. I don't get to do parts that I believe in anymore. And it just riles me. It doesn't break my heart. It makes me very angry, truly. But all of these shows were exquisitely written. They had the finest writers in the world in radio. I don't know where they've gone. I don't know whether they've retired or what they're doing.
Wasn't exactly a 10-1 outfit, more of a mud show, dog and pony type, you know, rag front.
Wait a minute, are you talking about?
Huh?
And by the way, where were you last night?
I missed the last bus in from the cow tower, so I had to do a star pitch. Connie thought that.
Oh, if you think I'm going to ask what a star pitch is, you're mistaken. What were you doing at the cow tower?
Oh, just fooling around.
Oh. Sam?
Yes?
Sam?
Yes?
Sam?
You ask too many questions. Sweetheart? In the patois of the carnival, I'll be right there to pitch my spiel, steal my pitch, and make with the canvas and the bluebeard caper.
Dashiell Hammett, America's leading detective fiction writer and creator of Sam Spade, the hard-boiled private eye, and William Spear, radio's outstanding producer-director of mystery and crime drama, join their talents to make your hair stand on end with the adventures of Sam Spade.
I was so delighted to get that role on Sam Spade. You see, Effie Perrine was not written the way I played her in the original Maltese Falcon. She was just as much of a wisecracker as Sam. She was almost a masculine or a female Sam. And I discussed this with Bill Spear, who directed the show and, of course, wrote it, really. He wrote it with the help of a lot of other people, and some very fine writers were on it. Bill Tallman and Gil Dowd wrote it at the beginning. And he and I decided that it would enhance Sam's character even more, make him more masculine, if Effie were very kind and sweet and good. And kind of a soft little creature, you know, just a dear, good little girl. And we were proving to everybody that he went around and made love to a million other girls, but he always came back to Effie. And that was the essence of my characterization. That was the sweetness on the show. Because he was always kidding me terribly. You know, a lot of it was ad-lib, too. A lot of the stuff we did on, and the Sam and Effie spots were ad-lib. Because we would spot somebody in the booth, and he would, we'd discuss them. Somebody would come to visit. See, it was a very popular show, and people did it for scale. They came down, good actors would never quibble about money on that show because they were so tickled to do it, so grateful to do it. But I must tell you that just for laughs, the boys who wrote it thought it would be fun to let me try another character because, you know, I did all kinds of characters in radio. I never just did one character, ever. So they wrote an old landlady for me who would appear in the script about every 2 or 3 weeks. And she was the smelliest old ghastly creature you've ever heard in your life. You could smell her over the air. She used to love to sit on the front porch and watch the kids play in the garbage cans. That was her joy for the day. Anything that was kind of filthy. Oh, she was an awful old person. And he, every rooming house that he went to, it was the same landlady. It was all over San Francisco, you know. He'd go down in the waterfront and there'd be the same landlady. But it was a gag and it was delightful. It was a very sophisticated show.
Period. End of Nightmare Alley, Bluebeard Division. Any questions, Ep?
Oh, just one, Sam. A grammatical error, but I'll correct it.
And just whom do you think you are to be correcting my grammar?
Who, Sam? Nominative case.
Nominal.
Nominative, Sam. The most frequently used cases in English are nominative, accusative, and possessive.
Mm.
Now, I'm referring to your sentence, which is, it might be hard to figure out which one of her to indict.
Yeah.
Of course, you meant them, since they're three darling sisters. Her being singular.
Indeed, her was singular, Effie.
Oh, Sam, you made a joke.
It's a very small one. Now, type that up and leave my grammar as is. It's colorful.
Oh, very well, Sam. I'll just fix the syntax as I go along.
Syntax? In California?
To her and made the correction back farther.
Back where, Twinkle Toes?
Twinkle Toes. You know, when you said three darling sisters, I changed it to one.
That's impossible. It takes two to make a sister.
That is not funny, Sam.
Who's laughing?
It's no laughing matter, Sam. After all, that Sylvia, the darling sister, whatever. And I don't care if she can go over Niagara Falls in a barrel.
Let's get it right, a beer keg.
That's the only funny thing is you being taken in. After all, snake charmers are that type of dime a dozen.
Well, here's 20 cents. Phone up that place.
What place?
Where you get the red-headed snake charmers, 12 for 10 cents.
Dime a dozen, Sam. It's a figment of speech.
You can say that again, sweetheart.
Tending to be three people, all with different hair, wearing snakes under a coverall.
Oh, I see.
No normal girl would do that, Sam.
I don't know. Women do all kinds of what.
Sam. Why can't I be an adventurous like some girls are?
I wouldn't trade you for 30 cents worth of snake charmers.
Oh, that's the nicest thing you ever said.
Well, next to the nicest.
Good night.
Good night, Salome.
I get very annoyed with people. I get very impatient with people who think that radio was only those morning soaps from New York or only those soaps and whatever particular shows came from Chicago, and they forget how many really glamorous shows we did from here. You see, I used to do the Frigidaire show, and I did the Academy Award show. I did Lux a lot, but that was always two big stars. It was always a male and a female star. Where on the Frigidaire show or the Academy Award show, I would always work opposite a star. I have a tape of me doing The Man Who Broke the Bank at Monte Carlo with Rex Harrison. And it's a delightful show. He rewrote it. He didn't care too much for the script as it was written. So he took it home and rewrote it. And the laughs are marvelous, and we work very well together.
Excuse me, madame. That is, mademoiselle. Anyhow.
Oh, really, Monsieur Gallard?
Does it matter?
We've been in the same hotel in Interlaken for 2 days, and I haven't danced with you. May I sit down here?
It's Bertrand's chair, and he might not like it.
Now, listen to me. I came to Interlaken to see you, not to see Switzerland.
You often have spells like this?
I said, listen. Supposing you've been poor for a long time and then suddenly became miraculously rich, happier and more carefree than ever in your life, free to follow your heart wherever it led. Tell me, are you married?
Oh, why?
I must know.
Well, it's all right, Helen. I've arranged for a guide tomorrow. Oh,
Oh, it's you again, Gallard.
Hello, Burton. I was asking your... madame, that is...
Madame?
He doesn't know, but... Monsieur Gallard, my brother.
Your brother?
Yes.
Well, how do you do, sir? Delighted. Well, over-delighted. Delighted, the brother of...
Berkeley. Helen Berkeley.
Helen Berkeley. Delighted. So you're a brother. Oh, I'm glad. Oh, that you look wonderful.
Yes, sir. Right.
Well, please stop pumping my arm or I'll never be able to go mountain climbing with Helen With Helen, did you say? Mountain climbing. Exhilarating sport. Mountain climbing. Very exciting. Brother. Oh, that's fine.
Bertrand, this is far enough.
Oh, can you see Gallard from up here?
He's resting on that rocky ledge below us.
Oh. Now, all you have to do is slide down the cliff a bit and land on the ledge beside it.
Yes.
Ha ha, alone on the mountain. That's excellent.
You're cheerful, aren't you?
When the stakes are high, my spirits rise with the stakes.
Well, all right. Loop the other end of my rope around this rock, will you?
All right, you are.
Well, here goes nothing.
Now, scream convincingly as you slide down, darling. Bon voyage!
Help! I'm slipping! Help! What was this?
Miss Berkeley.
I was on the ledge above you. I slipped.
You've no business climbing alone.
Well, don't leave me dangling here like a salami.
I'm very fond of salami.
Now, look.
I'm very fond of you.
Oh, please. Please cut this rope and let me down.
Will you go riding with me tomorrow?
No.
The next day?
No.
Friday?
Will you be good enough to get me down off this disgusting mountain, Mr. Gallagher?
Well, that's better. Now we're making some progress. Yes, I'll cut you down. Aren't you glad you accepted my invitation, Helen?
The name is Miss Berkeley. I hardly know you.
Then how about dancing tonight? After all, I practically saved your life. You dance beautifully, Helen.
That's a bright new speech.
The truth is eternal. You dance enchantingly.
Oh, thank you, Paul.
How about going boating tomorrow?
I'm afraid not.
Why not?
I saw an American tragedy years ago. They go boating. The gal falls into the drink. She can't swim. He lets her drown. Poor gal.
Ah, he didn't love that gal.
All right, Paul. I'll go boating with you.
Why, Helen? Why will you go with me?
Because I can swim.
Oh. Fine, yes. Well, we'll let's dance.
Why did you just stop rowing, Paul?
Let's drift.
I've been drifting.
And why are you unhappy?
Oh, Paul, I'm sorry if I showed it.
You're in some kind of trouble, aren't you?
Well, would you call marriage trouble?
You're not married.
I'm going to be married in 2 weeks.
No, I absolutely forbid it.
You don't even know him.
Who is he?
Pierre Prévost, the banker.
I'll knock him down.
It shouldn't be difficult. He's 62 years old.
62? Then why on earth?
Because he's rich. And I need money.
Why?
Not for myself, Paul. Believe me. For my brother.
Bertrand?
He's in trouble.
How much trouble?
5 million francs.
Well, I just happen to have 5 million francs. Would that help?
Paul. Oh, Paul.
What is it, darling? Tell me.
Oh, this is so dreadful. You make me feel so humble, so terribly ashamed. Can't you see? Don't you understand?
Well, Helen, all I know is that I love you very much and that I can't bear to see you unhappy. Anyway, I never could be trusted with money.
Oh, thank you, Paul. Thank you.
Then it's settled. You take the money.
It is settled, Paul.
I'll never take the money. But thank you. Thank you so much for offering.
Isn't there something I can do?
Oh, yes, Paul, there is. Give me another week of all this. Riding with you, dancing, laughing, talking with you. Perhaps the Mediterranean?
Capri. Anna Capri. The Blue Grotto.
Riviera. Monte Carlo.
Marseille, Naples, did you say Monte Carlo?
Yes. Why?
Hmm? Oh, nothing, darling, but if you want to go to Monte Carlo, we go to Monte Carlo, win, lose, or draw.
In my case, I was respected, truly respected as an actress in radio. I was up on a pedestal. I was, they said, the first lady of radio, but of course there were quite a few others that they called that. But it was one of the names they gave me. As a matter of fact, it says so on this Frigidaire show with Rex. Now, no one questioned my acting. I didn't have directors telling me how to read lines or how to characterize or giving me a lot of direction, shall we say. But in television now, it seems like whatever I do, they're reading lines for me or directing me in such a way that they give me the impression that I don't know from nothing. And I don't understand that. I really don't understand it. Can you imagine, in my capacity as an actress now, being asked to play opposite Rex Harrison? Now, I can. I'd like to, and I could. I have the ability. You can't lose your talent. But somehow, they kind of resented us radio actors. I think they would like to, you know, wanted to see us pushed down again. You know, we were so successful. We made so much money, really. We were, you know, in enviable positions. And good actors, too. The good radio actors were good actors, period. From theater or films or whatever they came from. One of the finest radio actors I ever worked with was Cary Grant. And he and I... See, in these books that they write, they give a lot of other people credit for having open suspense because it was in New York. I guess it did open there. I didn't think it did. I thought it opened here. Because Cary Grant and I opened Suspense, that fine, fine mystery show, at CBS here in Hollywood. And the show was so successful and so wonderful that we repeated it the second year, the very same show. I don't know why they didn't do it every year. But you see, Cary Grant is a fine actor, period. He just is a good actor. And a good actor can read. Or bring to life the characters as he reads. See, radio acting is not reading. It is being while you read. You have to create a whole human being. These days, I find that most of the people who do voiceovers and vocal work in the background, an awful lot of cartoon people and a lot of commercial people, have kind of resorted to a cartoon sound where we never did. See, they used to laugh about it, and they used to make remarks about it, which annoyed me. They'd say, well, bring out Voice 22. Well, I couldn't bring out Voice 22 until I had a person behind it. I could, on the air, I could play on a show a person I created visually, a whole flesh and blood human being. And I would come home, and my little niece would say to me, I love that lady you played with black hair with a bun on the back and long earrings and a green dress. You know, I created it so accurately that there was no doubt in anybody's mind who I was playing. I was not doing a voice. Of course, a lot of the shows were put on awfully fast, you know. One summer, I did the Sam Spade show and the Orson Welles show all at once. It seemed to me they were on at the same time, practically. So I said to Orson, I can't make this rehearsal. I can possibly make the show in about 3 minutes if I can get from NBC to CBS. NBC to CBS. But I said, I can't rehearse. And he said, well, come over and rehearse noontime then, during the lunch hour. So I would come over there, and of course he always loved to talk. And he would talk all through lunch, and I wouldn't get to rehearse with him because he always had a coterie of people around him, you know, and wanted to hear him talk. So, I would just sit there, you know, with my script in my hand. Then I'd have to hand the script back because they say, oh, there'll be a lot of changes, so you better not take it with you. What is now the Huntington Hartford was the Vine Street Theater, where we did an awful lot of work. I did a show there, an audience show called Romance. We used to do the Joey Brown show there. I was on that for years, playing his silly girlfriend. I used to say, I worked with comics a lot. I like to work with comedians. I find that a joy. I like the sound of laughs, I will say that. But I almost always you have a good, well-written part on a good comedy show. They give you good lines. They give you good things to say because comedy writers are the best. They're the most brilliant people in the world. I was on the Dick Haynes series. I was on The Whistler a great deal, which was a marvelous mystery show. I did Twins on that one time, which was really an exceptional performance. I did a good girl and a bad girl, but the same sound because they were twins. They were not a blonde girl and a brunette girl. You know, they were twins. And they gave me two microphones, and I created two different kinds of people. It's very interesting and a very good show. I was given a lot of marvelous things to do. I went back to New York one time, and they put me on CBS Workshop, it was called, Columbia Workshop show. And just to show my versatility, they had me do seven characters on the show, starring me, in New York. And give me really hard, some hardship, they were all German. So I had to go all over my hotel trying to get different kinds of German accents. You see, just as we have in this country, we have the New England accent, and we have the Southern accent, and we have different kinds, Middle West, actually. And so I had to get some different sounding kind of people. I didn't want them all to sound as if they came from the same family, of course, or the same part of Germany. So I've been given some very rough things to do many times in my career. I always say that if a part comes up and they say, good gracious, who can play that? And they say, let's let Tuttle try it. She'll do something with it. Now, of course, I did work for Arch Obler a lot. I must bring his name up because I loved working for him. Arch is the only director that I can think of who really lets me work the way I want to. Arch never says to you, to use a very corny old phrase, louder and funnier. He always, the impression he gives you is, get it like a human being. Whatever you do, if you want to bring it down to a person who can hardly be heard, if that's the kind of a person you're playing, do it. He always wanted the human sound and everything, and I loved it because that's what I prefer. I don't like to have to exploit a character. I don't like to have to go beyond. And I find that many times I do, and I don't give good performances. When they tell me louder and funnier, they're going to get a very bad performance out of me because I don't react to it well. I did an Arch Obler show with Joan Crawford one time, too. I used to work with her a lot in radio because she kind of needed me there. She was scared, and she felt more secure if I were there, even to stand kind of close to her. Which was very touching to me. Joan is a marvelous person. I named my daughter after it. I don't think she knows it. Because my daughter is Barbara Joan Ruick. And I've never told Joan that the Joan in there is for her.
And now, Autolite brings back to a Hollywood soundstage Miss Joan Crawford as Clara in The 10 Years by Mel Dinelli. A tale well calculated to keep you in suspense.
You see how clearly I remember things. I remember so well the horror of that moment when Doug's little friend finished telling me how he had left Doug there alone with my sister Adele. And I even remember what Roy said at the end.
So I came back to tell you, Mrs. Foley, on account of Doug made me. But now I wish I hadn't left him there with her. I know she's your sister and all, but I saw her face when she came to the window. She looked awful, Mrs. Foley. She looked awful crazy.
I followed Roy's directions, and I went by foot north along the ocean. I must have walked a good mile before I came to the house. The front door was standing open. There was a lamp burning on the table. Adele. She lay on the bed. I couldn't see her very clearly by the candlelight, but I could see that she was fully dressed. Her hair was undone and it fell down over the pillow. For a moment, I thought she was dead.
What do you want?
Adele.
What do you want?
It's me, Clara. Where's Douglas?
He's dead.
Adele!
Your husband is dead, Adele.
I don't mean my husband. I mean my son. Where is he?
He was murdered with a long shot.
Be still! You don't know what you're saying. Where is my son?
I haven't seen him.
You have. He was here, I know that.
I haven't seen him.
Yes, you have. Try and remember. Where is he?
I don't know.
Yes, you do know. What have you done to him?
Was he your son?
Yes, Adele. Please.
I hated him.
I know. Where is he, Adele?
He went away.
Where? Where did he go?
He went to the village for a doctor.
Are you telling me the truth?
Yes.
How long ago did he leave?
I don't remember.
Will you stop questioning me? Can't you see that I'm sick? I tell you, he went for a doctor.
Why do you come here, Clara? After 10 years. I've come to help you.
I don't need your help.
Adele, did Doug really go for the doctor?
You think I'm lying?
I don't know. But if he isn't back soon, I'm going for the police.
The police? Those fat fools. I'm so sick, Clara.
Oh, no. I'm going to take your things off, Adele. You'll be more comfortable. Then when the doctor comes. If he comes.
Don't you touch me.
You're sick, Adele. Let me take your things off.
No, no. Can't you leave me alone? Leave me alone! How do you know what's good for me after all these years? I'm in pain, Clara. I have a heavy pain here by my heart. When I'm tightly laced, I can almost bear it.
All right, darling, we'll leave it till the doctor comes.
Will the doctor help me, Clara?
Of course he will.
Douglas Foley came between two sisters.
Oh,
Adele. He worked in the garden, bending down low. I'm so tired, Clara.
I know. Try and rest, Adele. Close your eyes.
He was working in the garden, and I was on my way home. I saw him there, Clara. He looked the same after 10 years, because he had your strength to draw from. But I was alone. I had grown old. And he had stayed young.
And then she seemed to doze off. Her breathing was so labored. And I thought, perhaps she'll rest more easily if I undress her. I went over to the bed. She was wearing a corset. I reached over and I began to unhook it. She started mumbling something in her sleep.
Book from Palms. Always and forever you untap.
But she didn't wake up.
Always.
And I finally managed to take her corset off. But as I went to place it on a chair, I noticed something sticking out of the material. At first, I thought it was a broken stay, but it was round, and one end was sharp. I looked closer. It was a steel knitting needle. A long steel one. And there was rust on it. Or was that brown stain rust? Adele had concealed a knitting needle, and there was proof of what I guess I'd always known, that Adele had murdered my husband. I dropped the needle to the floor. Then something caught my eye. There was a hand sticking out from beneath the bed. It was white and still. It was a child's hand. I fell to my knees. Oh, Doug! Doug! And just as I reached out for him, I felt a sharp blow on the back of my head.
fortune.
I dreamed that Adele and I were children again, that she was laughing, and we were playing an old game of ours where we tied each other up with our bathrobe cords, and then we waited for a knight in armor to rescue us. And then I think it was the odor of kerosene that brought me to. The room was filled with it. Oh, my head was pounding. I couldn't seem to focus my eyes. I tried to raise myself to my feet, but I couldn't seem to move my arms, my legs. Suddenly, I realized why. I was tied with a bathrobe cord. I was a child again. Adele and I were playing our games again. My husband and everything that had happened between Adele and me had been nothing but a bad dream. Oh, a feeling of relief swept over me. Suddenly, I heard footsteps. And the door creaked slowly open. And then I knew that what had happened had not been a dream. For Adele stood there in the doorway. Not Adele, the child who would rescue me. But Adele with gray hair, who hadn't spoken to me for all those years. She wore a long dressing gown. She was barefoot, her long hair streaming about her shoulders. There was a vacant, stupid smile on her face. She carried a bucket in her hand, and the odor of kerosene filled the room. She didn't seem to notice me as she went past me. She threw the liquid from the bucket onto the bed.
Adele! Adele! No, Adele!
But she paid no attention to me. She left the room again. I struggled wildly, but it was no use. Oh, I was tied securely, and then I saw a still figure on the bed. It was Doug. Oh, his face was so white. He was unconscious, and there was a deep gash at the side of his head. Then Adele came back into the room. She had filled a bucket to the brim. And she walked toward the bed again.
Clara?
Adele, untie me.
Untie you? Why?
Adele, listen to me.
This is your son, Clara.
Yes, Adele, untie me.
You were looking for him, and he was here all the time.
Please, untie me, Adele.
I never knew your son. In years, I never knew him. How old is he, Clara?
He's only 10. He's just a boy. Adele, you're sick. Untie me and we'll go for a doctor.
You want me to be well, Clara?
Yes. Untie me.
Are we friends again, Clara?
Yes, we're friends. I want to help you.
But I can't forget the 10 years, Clara. I must wash those years away before we can really be friends again.
Oh, Adele, forget those years. Let me help you. Untie me.
No. We can't forget them, Clara. We must wash them away. That's what I was doing. I was washing away the years. Your husband's gone. Your son is all that remains of him. Then we can be sisters again.
You don't know what you're doing. Untie me, Adele.
But this isn't love, is it? I haven't...
No, you see, you're sick.
Well, I put into the lamps to make them burn.
No!
I could burn away the years.
Oh!
That would be better.
Oh,
much
no!
Better.
No, Adele, for the love of heaven, untie me.
I'll burn away these years that remain on the bed.
No, Adele.
If I could do that with this candle, then you and I could really be friends again. Like when Mother was alive. We could be sisters again. Always and forever.
We're sisters now, Adele.
You're lying. We're not sisters.
Adele, listen to me. We're children. And you've tied me with this cord. And now you must untie me. Like you used to do when you left me too long and I cried.
You're lying. We're not sisters and we haven't been for years. And now I'm going to punish you for lying. Just as Mother used to punish us when we were children.
Then she started walking unsteadily toward me, a lighted candle in one hand, the bucket in the other, the liquid slapping over her dressing gown as she walked.
Clara! Do you remember the time Mother washed out my mouth with soap when she caught me in a fib? That's what I'm going to do to you now. Or perhaps it would be better if I burned you.
No! No!
Breathe
in,
Clara. Oh. Awaken your precious son. We mustn't waken him.
Adele, I'm timing. I promise you that I'll take Doug and we'll go away. You'll never have to see us again.
No, Clara.
And she kept moving towards me, holding the lighted candle close to her breast.
You mustn't ever lie to me again, Clara.
Adele, you're ill. You don't know what you're doing.
Wash away the years. Burn away the years.
Oh, suddenly, I saw a tiny flicker of flame on her breast. The filly dressing gown. She'd held the candle too close. Her entire dressing gown was a mass of flames that spread swiftly to her hair. In a moment, she was a blazing torch. And the odor of burning filled the room. Oh, I could see her face. Surprised and contorted with pain. Oh, she turned and looked towards the bed a second, the bucket flaming in her hand. But then she went screaming out the door and towards the sea. Mrs. Foley. Yes?
You mustn't scream like that.
I wasn't screaming. That was my sister, Adele.
Yes, I know. Try not to think about it, Mrs. Foley.
You knew my sister was burned to death, didn't you, Mrs. Willard? Oh, she was so very beautiful.
Yes, I know. Try and rest. Is there anything I can get you before I go to bed?
No, thank you.
Well, go to sleep then.
I will. Good night.
Good night, and pleasant dreams.
Was that my sister, Mrs. Willard?
No, Mrs. Foley. It's one of the others.
Oh, they scream because they remember things.
Yes, I suppose they do. Good night.
Good night. I remember things, too. I remember.
Promise me you'll never leave me, Clara. And that whatever I do, you'll do. I promise. Always and forever.
Always and forever. I promise.
Players. I must discuss that. 12 actors, top actors, got together and decided to have a show that was a house show. CBS house show. We didn't care how much we got. You know, we didn't care. I'll tell you how much we got. $49.60. That's all we got for a half hour show. And we decided to do shows we liked. And we chose the scripts. We cast each other in certain roles. And, for instance, we were sitting around in our first reading of the script. Somebody would say, oh, that's your part. Oh, is that your part? You'll be so marvelous in that. And the actor would say, yes, but it's so close to me, I don't want to play it. It's too easy for me. I want to play something I don't know anything about. And that's how the rehearsals went. They were just fascinating because good actors were communicating with each other in a marvelous and stimulating way. And, oh, I just had so many wonderful roles on that because we picked up some very good young writers at that time. Lawrence and Lee wrote a lot of our scripts, and they were just starting then. And John Michael Hayes used to write our scripts. We were picking up young embryo writers at that time. And, oh, it was a marvelous thing. I'd love to try a thing like that again. Dragnet. I was on Dragnet quite a few times. And the Jimmy Durante show. One of the funniest breakups I've ever heard in my life heard on the Jimmy Durante show. It was a thing where everybody laughed for about 10 minutes. We couldn't get back on the groove. We couldn't get the show back on. But he made a funny little mistake, and it was in a scene with me. I was supposed to... it was always a gimmick. Every week it was a gimmick. I was to come out, well, say, as a librarian. He'd come in and ask for some books. And then I would explain what things they had in these books. And it would be about a long paragraph of great big 10 or 8 and 10 syllable words. And I'd have to get them exactly accurate and straight so that he could then garble them. Although they didn't garble them for him at all. They wrote them straight for him. He did enough to them. And he said something that was not, you know, it was something you wouldn't expect to hear over the air. Well, I've never heard an audience go to pieces so much in my life. It was just, it was so much fun, of course. And the booth, you know, when something happens out there on the microphones and you look at the booth, they disappear. You know, when somebody said some terrible thing to you they didn't expect to say, you're looking for help there and there's not a soul there. They were all on the floor. And you can't do anything. Elliot Lewis said something to me one time on the air, and it was so shocking I could hardly believe it, but I looked in the booth and there was nobody there, so I decided he had said what I thought he said. So I had to go on. But luckily I had 2 pages of narration. There was a thing called This Is My Story, a very sobby thing. It was a marvelous show. I loved doing it because I could sob all over the place. It was very dramatic. So I just cried for 2 pages. And it wasn't difficult at all for me because it just got sadder and sadder as the time went on. All the laughing I wanted to do, I put into crying. There was a thing called Hollywood Star Playhouse. It was fine, too. I did My Man Godfrey on the air one time with William Powell. And I did it so much like Carol Lombard, it made him cry. He just said, oh, that's just the girl. You've got her. Just got her completely. You see, in radio, when you're out there doing a live show in front of an audience, and you have your script in your hand, nobody will stop you. Nobody can change your performance. See, anybody as arrogant as I am about my work and about my acting, that's pure heaven. I don't like it any other way. I don't want somebody to come over and say, I don't think you did that quite right, or would you stand a little taller there? Don't put your head down this. And why did you look over at that place there? You know, I don't want all these criticisms while I'm trying to concentrate on the characterization. Because when you're on radio, you're on. And nobody can hurt you. Nobody can distort your performance. Now, I can't remember what coffee company sponsored the Baby Snook Show. But I was on that a great deal. See, they would have the Baby Snook spot, and they would almost always have a good dramatic spot or a good comedy spot. And I was in almost all of the other spots. And I worked opposite Frank Morgan one time, and I've never heard an audience laugh so much. I have never been so, you know, just elevated to the rafters with excitement and joy because it went so well. And to work opposite him and keep, you know, play that ball game, throw that ball back and forth the way we did. See, I always like to work with the top people. I'm not very good when I work with people who are not very good. I'm just not. I like to work with people who are vibrant and know their business. I work 1,000 times better if I have a challenge. I think it comes from being a Leo, like I am. I just think, you know, because I'm a Leo, I roar that way. I would not like to see radio go to the unworthies, as it might. I'd want to see radio put back in the old-timers' hands. The ones who directed it and the agencies who handled it. I wouldn't want to see radio done in any of the people's hands in the last 20 years, maybe. I shouldn't say that, because there's some very bright young people that I adore lately. I shouldn't say that. I just would... The unscrupulous shouldn't have their fingers in radio, ever.
Reminiscing I feel you near. Once more, you're my love of yesteryear.
Be with us next week for another nostalgic look at radio of yesteryear.
Just about time we were picking up our members and moving along our way. I hope you've enjoyed listening to these songs and the memories that go with them, as much as I've enjoyed bringing them to you. And I'll be keeping my weather eye peeled. Yes, sir. Looking for you all to join us the next time we drop around this way for a friendly little get-together. And I hope that'll be real soon, folks. And until then, this is your old friend, Singin' Sam, saying goodbye for now.
Same Time, Same Station is produced for KRLA News and Public Affairs by John Price. Associate Producer, Cam Currier. Special Research by Martin Halpin. Our thanks to Miss Lorene Tuttle, our guest on tonight's program.
Be sure to be with us next week at this same time, same station.